Instant Authority Expert, episode number 37.
Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of Entrepreneur on Fire, and you are listening to Instant Authority Expert Podcast with Keith Shannon. Position yourself for success.
What does it take to become an expert? It takes motivation, stick-to-itiveness. Oh, and the right tools don't hurt either. Welcome to Instant Authority Expert, the podcast designed to help you position yourself for success. Here's your host, Keith Shannon.
What's going on, people? You're listening to the station that's changing the nation one episode at a time. Hi, everybody. Today's show is all about Canada's metal queen, Lee Aaron. But first, here's her bio. Lee Aaron was born in Belleville, Ontario, and began singing in school musicals at the age of five. She was discovered singing in a music production when she was 15 years old and was asked to join a local rock band called Lee Aaron. Lee Aaron's debut album, The Lee Aaron Project, was released in 1982. In late 82, Aaron flew to New York and posed topless for the men's magazine We. The magazine's March 1983 issue featured Aaron on the cover and an interview. Aaron later concluded that posing for the magazine damaged her music credibility. She regretted the decision and assigned blame for it from then pressure from her manager. 1984's recording of the album Metal Queen resulted in a multi-album deal with Attic Records. Between 84 and 92, Aaron toured almost non-stop, including over 20 European tours and appearances in Japan, the U.S. She released six albums on Attic Records in Canada, as well as international releases in the UK, Germany, Austria, Italy, Scandinavia, Australia, and Japan. She has won three Toronto Music Awards for Best Female Vocalist, 10 Juno nominations, and topped dozens of European music polls. Her greatest commercial success came with the release of Body Rock in 1989. The album spawned several hit songs, including What You Do to My Body, and was certified double platinum in Canada. But enough from me! Without further ado, please welcome to the show, the one, the only, Lee Aaron! Yeah, baby, what's going on?
Yeah, baby.
Yeah!
I'm sitting here with my laptop downstairs, but I'm actually sitting here in front of my Macintosh, in front of my GarageBand, looking at new songs I'm recording. So there you go. That's what's at right now.
I love it. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself, Lee, and what's going on in your life today? Really, your chance to plug anything you like.
Well, I've taken a bit of a hiatus from recording, or I had taken a bit of a hiatus from recording because I became a mom. Few years ago, I got an amazing little 8-year-old boy and 10-year-old girl, when they're just so creative and so fun. But I'm getting back into writing and recording this year, and hope to have a new studio album out in 2015. I'm also working with a gentleman from Toronto, guitar player named Sean Kelly. He's amazing.
You know Sean Kelly? Yeah, I'm gonna get him on the show. Metal and Ice.
Yes, he and I are great buds, and he's been playing in my live band, and we're writing some material together as well. So, yeah, it's been rocking.
That's awesome. Are you ready to tell the Instant Authority Army all about perseverance, success, and how to make dreams come true, Lee?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, let's walk the walk and talk the talk. I always like to start off every show with a little thing called Instant Authority Expert, where you tell my audience in 5 minutes or less the steps on how you became an expert in your particular field of interest. And Lee, yours is being one of the greatest Canadian female artists of all time. Can you tell us how that happened?
All I can tell you is if you read Malcolm Gladwell, there's something to be said for those 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Practice, practice, practice. Don't give up. Don't pack it in. You know, it took the Beatles. They couldn't get a record deal in North America when they first tried. You know, I mean, there's something to be said for not giving up, for putting in those hours and honing your craft and just plugging away. And also, the other thing I think that helps you be great is you need to learn from the masters, right? You need to go back and you need to listen to great music in the first place to become a great musician, I think. There's something really to be said about that. And just put in the work. That's all I can really say.
I love it. Would you say what you practice in private, you're rewarded for in public?
Sometimes I write. Sometimes I write complete shite. You know, I mean, we all do.
Well,
right?
You know, you got to write a couple of crappy songs to get a couple of good ones.
Yeah, like for every great song, you know, somebody wrote 9 crappy ones.
I usually write about 20 crappy to 1 good. So
there you go. So yeah, you just got to. But you know, when you write that song, you know it. You know it. And you want to know the funny thing? What You Do to My Body, which was my biggest Canadian hit. When we took those demos in to work with the producer, he didn't hear it. And I'm like, no, no, no. They wanted to toss that song. And I'm like, no, 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 no. You guys are mental, and this is a great song. And I pushed and pushed and pushed, and we reworked it a bit in pre-production, and lo and behold, it became the single and my biggest hit. So, you know, I think I've got good song instincts. You know,
your songs rock.
I think I do. Thank you.
Well, Lee, here at Instant Authority Expert, we believe that success leaves clues, to quote Anthony Robbins. And what I try to share with my audience is the common thread, the rituals, the patterns, and the excellence that makes success possible. All right, Lee, let's dive right into how you became an Instant Authority Expert. Lee, let's talk about passion. Tell me what you love about what you do.
What I love about what I do is when you're working on a great song, even in the studio or you're on stage, there's two different components to it, actually. There's the songwriting component, and then there's the performance component. And songwriting, when you and with songwriting and with performance, when it's great, you are not present. You totally get out of the way and you're the vessel. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense. I'm a musician.
And I can't tell you how many times I've had that feeling where it's just completely transcended. Like I feel like something comes, words come out of my mouth, or a melody comes out and I go, whoa, where did that come from? I feel like I didn't even create it. Does that make sense?
It totally does. I mean, a lot of the people that listen to this show are songwriters themselves, and there are those magical moments.
Yeah. And one thing that... I know I talk about working and, you know, working really, really hard at stuff, but sometimes I've learned my lesson in that if you really have to rework a song that many times to get it to work, it's probably not working.
It usually doesn't work. The harder you work on a song, it comes out of the air, doesn't it, Lee?
Yeah, it's sort of like for me, the best songs are written in 10 minutes. And that's always the way it goes, right? And, there's just something where it's, the seed's planted, it blossoms, it's there, and you've got your framework of your song, and you know it's working, right? And, I find if I have to, you know, gee, the verse isn't working, I've really got to work this again and again, it's best to shelve it for a while.
Yeah. Nick Walsh and I actually had that conversation about songwriting, and we kind of agreed that those quick ones, they come through the air from the universe, wherever they come from, they're usually 10-minute songs, boom, they're hits, and they sound great. It's the ones that you slave over for weeks and weeks and months, you bring them to the band, and they're like, that's not that good.
I know. It's true. Well, and... the other thing I've learned is, you know, take your favorite phrase of everything you've written and be prepared to let it go, because not everyone's going to think it's great. And, you know, we get emotionally attached that way sometimes to some of the stuff we've done. Right?
So true.
It's good. And my other thing about passion is I will, you know, it's funny because when I was talking about starting to record again, I talked to a few people in recording and a few different artists I want to work with. And they're like, oh, you know, you can just do this. You can just send it the files to Toronto. I can lay down a guitar.
Yeah.
I can do this. I'm like, that's not going to happen, because I'm totally old school in that I will never, ever record bed tracks unless everybody's in the same room at the same time.
That's awesome.
And it feels like a band, because that's just... that's how a lot of real crappy music gets made. That's what I think.
That's awesome.
Music, yeah. So
I love that. I love that. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, well,
get in a room with a couple of people and plug in.
Yeah, that's the way. It's got to be live off the floor that way. I just don't believe in doing a record any other way.
I love that. So. Well, You know, it's no secret I'm a super huge Lee Aaron fan, so let's get into it. Let's start at Under Your Spell. I think it's an amazing song. That song was from the Lee Aaron Project in 1992, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, your first studio album.
1982.
Sorry, I have that. Sorry. 1980.
You're trying not to date me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
1982. So let me do that again. I'll erase that. Lee, let's start at Under Your Spell. What an amazing song. That song was from the Lee Aaron Project in 1982, your first studio album. Correct me if I'm wrong. And you did.
Yeah.
What an amazing time. What an amazing experience. Can you share with IAE what that experience was like?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we were talking just before we started this interview about some stuff and some of my earlier work. I'm really going to have to dig deep here because you got to remember I was really
young. Yes, you were.
I was really, really young when I started out. So here I was, you know, I had basically been discovered by my first manager playing at like an open air thing at a park near where I lived in Brampton, Ontario. And I was a teenager. I just finished high school, barely finished high school. And he sort of plucked me out of that situation, put me on the road for a while. And then he's like, okay, we're going to do a record. And he went and found all of these artists that he had connections with. Frank Soda, whom
yeah,
I was
yeah.
talking to just last week. Frank Soda, the guys from Moxie, the guys from Santers. And he just sort of threw me into this situation. And I had written a little bit of material with my high school band, right? My high school rock and roll band. But I'd never really worked with pros. And so he sort of, Under Your Spell was like, you know, like, I'm trying to remember, did I write that with Dave Applin?
I think it was Santers. It was you, Santers,
yeah.
And maybe Soda, but no, maybe it was the other guy.
I think it's Dave Applin.
I think you're right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so this was just like, these were like the first four songs we wrote together, and Under Your Spell was just, came out of that. And, you know, it's hard for me to listen to some of my real early work because I feel like, well, the lyrics aren't very mature and I sound like a little girl. But a lot of people really, it really resonated with a lot of people apparently. So yeah, and then that was cool. So we ended up writing this song. And then as an afterthought, my manager said, you know, I'm going to see if we can get Rick Emmett to come in and sing on this because he would sound great on this tune. And he did. And so there you go. I think that Rick Emmett's vocals elevated that song to yet another level. Yeah, but that was the story of that song. It was just one of the first songs I sat down and wrote with Rick.
I haven't heard that song for many, many years, so I was checking that out before I knew we were doing this interview, and it absolutely is still a killer, killer song. I actually watched somebody uploaded the video of the song onto YouTube. It was amazing. It was amazing.
Wow, thank you.
You're welcome.
There you go.
Now, from that album, we get to 1984. That was a big year for you. That was the launch of Metal Queen. You had two big hits from that album, Shake It Up and Metal Queen. And I know that those aren't your total favorite songs off that album. Can you talk about that album a little bit? Because that's when I got to really, really know you, and maybe the world really, really knew you. It was huge, man.
Thank you. Well, it definitely sort of catapulted me to iconic status with a lot of...
It was Lita
bands,
Ford,
you know?
And Lee Aaron.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I basically wrote that material when I was on the road with my first band, and I wrote most of that material with my high school guitar player, George Bernhardt.
Wow.
He and I, well, we actually went to sister high schools in the Brampton-Bramalee area, and then he came over and joined our school orchestra because we didn't have a good guitar player, and that's how we ended up all connecting and playing in this sort of after hours rock band. And so I wrote that with George, and what ended up happening was we ended up going over, my manager arranged for us to go over and play at Reading Festival. I had managed to catch the attention of a writer from Kerrang! Magazine who did a big two-page feature on me. And the next thing you know, they were asking me to come to play Reading Festival. And we filmed, well, the live video for Shake It Up is from that festival. And and in the meantime, we had also done the Metal Queen video. And I mean, the whole idea behind that video originally was, you know, it was around the time of the Conan the Barbarian movie and stuff. And we were
movie Heavy Metal, right?
Yeah. Yeah, let's make this like a fantasy kind of thing. But then you know, people thought that I, you know,
that
like,
you were the metal queen. Yeah.
Yeah. I made my coffee in the morning in a loincloth. Right. So it was like, or I wore a fur bikini when I was shopping. It's like, you know, yeah. Be gone or I shall behead you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it was a serious, serious video. I'm perfect living example of, like, we were all mesmerized. I mean, it was a killer song, though. Like, I mean, you know, you look amazing in the video, but it was a killer song. That's where that song is still killer. I listened to it today. I haven't listened to it in a while. Metal Queen still kicks ass.
Thank you. It's
You're
totally,
welcome.
I went through a little phase of not wanting to play it just because I felt so pigeonholed and labeled by it. But we've gotten back to playing it in its original form live. With Sean Kelly in the band, and it's just, it totally kicks. It's amazing.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And fans love it.
I watched the Sweden Rock Fest. You guys were doing it there.
I'm not sure if we did the original. I think we did a hybrid.
Yeah, I know
it
was a newer version. It wasn't the original. Yeah.
But so you should check out some of the, like, 2013, 2014 YouTubes that are up online of it. So yeah, it's, and when I wrote that song, I was, basically, for me, it was all about, you know, I had a pretty controlling dad in my growing
right.
up. And, you know, I'm not to get all psychoanalytical here on you, but for me, I played out, I think, a lot of that stuff in my early artistry with my music. And Metal Queen was just a song about having your own voice, about
being a strong woman, right?
Being empowered as a woman. You know, not, you know, it's like, lick my boots, baby.
Right.
Nobody, you
right.
know, I'm a force to be reckoned
yeah,
with.
Yeah.
And I'm not like all those other, you know, girls and frilly dresses. And, you know, that was just sort of my stance. Right. And, but I think that resonated with a lot of women, not just women. I think men as well. Right. Just to be empowered like that. However, yeah, people sometimes, they took the song as to be autobiographical, which it wasn't really intended to be originally.
But
so.
still kick ass. I mean, let me ask you one question about the Reading Festival. I remember watching that video, Shake It Up, and I always wondered where that was. I don't think I knew back in the day that it was over in Europe. But can you tell me, I mean, that it looks like a crazy concert. Was that your first really, really, really big concert?
Yes, it was actually. I was, I don't know, like 20 years old.
Yeah, you were young.
And here I am. I'm walking out my first big festival like that.
There was a lot of people.
There were 60,000 people there, and I was just like crapping my pants before I walked out on stage. And then, like I said, then that sort of transcendent thing happens where you just go, okay, you know, you're possessed and you just do it. And, but it was wild. They eventually ended up having to put chicken wire up, in future years, because these people, it's like if they, in Europe and in England, especially, they sell like 2-liter pop bottles full of beer. Okay. And so, if they don't like you, they throw these half full bottles. They hurl these half full bottles on stage. But the thing is, if they like you, they throw stuff at you too. Have a beer, Lee. You know, it was just crazy. So you spend like half your time dodging all this stuff that's coming on the stage. It's like, it's kind of intimidating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember Mike Patton from Faith No More back in 92. He used to call that upon him, and they would just pelt him with water bottles. Yeah, crazy. So we're at Shake It Up and we're at the album Metal Queen. What was the climate like at that time? I mean, Much Music and MTV had just hit like Godzilla. And I remember those two videos in heavy rotation. What was that like and what did that do for your career? Because you were everywhere. I mean, instantly everywhere.
It was really good for me. I was very fortunate in that when I started out my first and second album, the new music had, music with Daniel Rischler and JD Roberts had, was in its inception as well. And then when Much Music came into being, they were just hungry for videos, anybody do any, especially Canadian content, anyone doing this. Right. And so here I show up, this is something of Canadian female has never done anything like this. This sort of really, this warrior goddess. It was like pre-Xena, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? It's true.
You know, it's just like, so it's just like mind blowing for people because it's, it's just so different. So yeah, I go into heavy rotation, and then all of a sudden I'm everywhere.
Yeah,
right?
You're everywhere.
It was crazy. Yeah. So there you go. But it was an exciting time.
It was a good time too.
It was a real exciting time. Because you know, there wasn't as much competition
for certain.
And like you, how do I explain it? The pool was smaller,
yeah.
Right? So,
good time to be alive. So good time to have videos out.
It was great. And, like it wasn't, like I said, this kid, like now with CGI and the YouTube, it's just like, it's totally different, right? The artistry has kind of gone out of video making now, really.
They're not even really doing video. They're still doing videos, but I mean, shows like MTV and Much Music are kind of like, they're just not what they used to be when we were younger.
Well, they don't play music anymore.
They play reality shows.
I know. It's
yeah, I had a conversation with a rock star last night for this show, and we were he's up next week, and we were talking about the same thing. So let's go off from there. Let's go off into next album. No Time Off for Good Behavior, right into the studio with Bob Ezrin for Call of the Wild. It's got some of the great songs on it. Barely Holding On, which you are back playing. Hot to Be Rocked, Rock Me All Over. Two of my personal favorite songs off that album are Running from the Fire and Paradise. I really fell in love with that album, Lee. Can you talk about Call of the Wild? I mean, Bob Ezrin.
Bob Ezrin. So Bob Ezrin, what ended up happening was that we were in the studio. We started out in the studio with Paul Gross, who produced Metal Queen.
Yep.
And that's where we originally started. But Paul had a racquetball accident, like almost took his eye out. It was crazy. And Bob Ezrin was next door in Studio B at Phase One Studios. And he was working on this, like, I don't know, it was some project album with, you know, Alice Cooper and Meatloaf and like all these famous artists were on it. But he kept coming into our studio and listening to what we were doing. He was really, really intrigued. But you know, who is this Canadian chick that sings like
right,
this,
right?
Right. And so when Paul got so ill and couldn't come back into the studio, we were going to have to take this hiatus. He went right into my record label and said, let me produce her. I would like to do this album.
That's awesome.
And so he just jumped on board, and working with him was a really different experience. So working with Bob was really amazing. You know, I was 22 years old, 21 or 22.
Wow.
I was really intimidated actually working with him because he was like this rock god. I mean, he produced Pink Floyd and Alice Cooper, for goodness sakes, you know? So I was like, yes, sir, no, sir, in the studio, really seriously with him. But it was also a crazy time because it was 84 when we were making the record, 85 when it came out. And it was this crazy time where everybody was still doing tons of cocaine. It was like, it was really seriously. And for me, I was still like a little kid. I was like,
you're young,
too young to be sort of into that yet. And too scared,
right,
if that makes sense. So I kind of wasn't totally on, you know, on the same level with everybody a lot of the times. I know one time that Dick Wagner came up to play some guitar, and him and Bob were like old school buddies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And at one point they locked me and John out of the control room, and they were like, we're working on a mix for Barely Holding On. We're going to surprise you. And they were in there for the longest time. And then they call us back in. They're like, okay, listen to this. And I'm listening, and it's like my vocal and a click drum.
Nice.
And I'm like, okay, you know what? It's time for you boys. Okay, I'm 22, but I've had enough. Time for you guys to go home and sober up.
No
back.
Kidding.
Let's do this right tomorrow. Like, there was, it was just like, it just sort of got out of control.
That's awesome.
But it was that decadent era where you could just spend thousands of dollars frittering away time in the studios, right? And like, and they just paid for it, right? But it was fun. And in the end, I think we ended up with a really fantastic record, and but it definitely has the Bob Ezrin stamp on it. He did his maestroing on that record, and it's really, really cool. I it ended up being our biggest selling album in Europe.
Really? Well, it is my, it's my favorite album. I actually still have it on cassette. Believe it or not, I traded that Lee Aaron because my buddy had that Call of the Wild cassette, and I had cassette at the time, and I traded for the Lee Aaron. I was like, gimme, gimme, gimme. That's a true story. 85, 86. I still have the cassette.
I won't tell that story.
So let's talk about the difference between the two albums. Now, we talked about this a little earlier. Did you feel the two albums, from Metal Queen to Call of the Wild, was it a total change, or do you think it was just the climate of the music scene at the time, from like 84, 85, 86?
Well, things definitely changed. You know, I found that there was way more of a change between 85 and 87. Because that Bon Jovi album
came out,
and that sort of, like, Living on a Prayer, it changed everything.
Changed radio.
It changed radio. It changed the way everybody was writing rock songs. Everybody started to move more into this, like, pop metal. Sort of arena, right? And and then everybody was sort of trying to emulate that a little bit, you know, and not just the artists, but the producers and the record companies. It's like, oh, everybody wanted a hit as big as Bon Jovi, right? And so then suddenly you're under that kind of pressure. I know that when we started getting ready to write for the next album, the Lee Aaron self-titled release from 1987, there was huge pressure. Like they were bringing in, you know, all kinds of outside material, and they were looking at how, you know, who can we hire that can, you know, work as a song doctor on our, like the whole song doctor movement happened as well, where all of these writers like Diane Warren and Jim Vallance and everybody that's like, okay, well, let's take Aerosmith now and let's put them together with Jim Vallance,
right?
Because he writes with Bryan Adams, and like let's see what we can do when we combine these raw, you know, garage band rock band guys with pop writers. And so this whole new sort of thing happened, right? And that was business at that time. Yep. So, you know, you talk about business. That's how the record companies thought they would get their Bon Jovi by doing that.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think it killed hair metal.
It totally did because it softened it all up.
It destroyed it, and it made it necessary for Nirvana to happen.
Yeah.
Just like
definitely.
Just like disco made it necessary for punk rock to come in, right?
Yeah, because they had to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know what? A lot of things happened, like 86 with the Def Leppard record too, Hysteria, right? It's a great album, but I mean, Mutt Lange went through that thing with a fine-tooth comb, and it's really not, it's recorded very, very pieced.
Yeah, well, and you know what? That's another Def Leppard and Bon Jovi. That's actually, you know, a great example that you brought up as well of that sort of... really,
overproduced, polished.
I mean, it was overproduced, but it was still great.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
that first awesome
album,
stuff.
But it could have been a Shania Twain record. That's, you know, I'm sorry for even saying that, but
true though. Any Mutt Lange, Bryan Adams, you know, Def Leppard. It's like, oh, I hear it. You can hear the Mutt Lange in there.
Exactly, and you know, I remember I went looking for the new Diana Krall record, and I went, oh. It's produced by David Foster, you know, and you know what? I think David is an amazingly talented human being and a, you know, musical person. But it's when he makes a record, it's really a David Foster record. It's more about David than the artist. That's, you know, I should be so lucky to ever work with him. I mean, I shouldn't. That's not a criticism. I don't really know what I'm trying to say here. It's not a criticism, but it's sort of like, you know.
No, you're speaking the truth.
You know what to expect. It's like, I'm going to get a little less of Diana Krall and more of a pop record. And as an artist who loves artists, that's less appealing to me than if I was just part of the pedestrian audience.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah. So So there you go. I said it. And
no, I love it. I think that, you know what?
Shoot.
We've had some rock stars on this show before. And you know what? That the same thing comes up. You know, we had Daryl Dwarf on from Killer Dwarves. We talk about that. You know, Nick Walsh talks about it. So, and now you're talking about it. I mean, I think as a music lover and a musician myself, I felt the same thing. You know, we all kind of got slammed in 92 there. And I think we're all still trying to rock out because we lost about 10 years, you know?
Exactly. Well, it's sort of like, how to explain it? If you knew that my new album was going to be produced by David Foster, I can't imagine anybody would be that excited.
Actually, you know what? Because it's David Foster,
it'd probably
sell like hotcakes.
People would be
happy that, you know what, that you got a new album out. And you know what? Nowadays, the partnering with David Foster brand would make it huge. You know what I mean? So nowadays, it's a little different than it was. It's like working with Bob Ezrin back in the day. It's like, you know, he worked with all the greats. It's like, oh my God, that's awesome.
Yeah, from a business standpoint, I totally hear what you're saying.
And this
I
is
do.
A business podcast. Yeah. We're just sticking in some music. So that was 1987 we were talking about. We got off, we're kind of in there a little bit with your album, Lee Aaron. Now, you had my favorite song off that album is I Can't Stop, I Can't Go. I'm caught between yes and no. I'm not sure if that's the title of it, but God, did I ever love that song. Can you talk about that song a little bit?
I'm going off the deep end.
Yeah, yeah. I can't stop. I can't go. I'm caught between yes and no.
Cool. You should go do a version of that.
I'm going to tell everybody at the next show I'm saying Lee Aaron told me that we're doing this.
That's called deep end. Going off the deep end. Yeah, going off the deep end.
I always remember that beginning, man. I always loved it.
Yeah, it's a great, great song. I wrote that with Mark Ribbler from New Jersey. John and I did. So, sorry, what was your question about?
My question was just, you know, like, hey, yeah, like, tell us about that. Tell us about the album. Tell us about that song. You had Powerline off that song, off that album too, right?
That's right. That's right. I wrote that with. I did some interesting collaborations on that album. I wrote with. Jolynn Turner.
Oh, you did? He was singing with and he did some stuff with Malmsteen there.
With Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow.
Yeah.
So I wrote quite a few tunes with Jolynn Turner. And I worked with Mark Ribbler. I'm trying to remember. I don't know. I have so many albums out. It's hard. I have about 12 albums, so I can't remember all the... all of the my co-writes, but those were a couple, and they were. Oh, and I wrote a song with Jim Vallance, I believe,
nice.
For the album, didn't I? Did it? Dangerous? Is this there's a song called Dangerous on that?
Possibly.
Album? No. No, sorry, wrong album. It's Some Girls Do, I think.
Oh, that's not 91. We're not there yet.
Yeah. I'm not there yet. Yeah, but. Yeah, and then I worked with Peter Coleman. We brought Peter Coleman in to produce. He had produced several Pat Benatar records. And I loved working with Peter. He had a real pop sensibility, but he still allowed us to sort of be ourselves, you know. Recording vocals with him was brutal, though, because he would punch a line in 100 times.
God.
One line to get it just right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And back then, you know, there was no pitch correction.
Right.
Not that I've never used pitch correction ever in my recording, but he was a super stickler for pitch. And like if it was like, even if it had tons of personality and was like a gnat's hair out, he'd make you
no
do it again.
No kidding.
With the personality. And it's like, oh man, like, yeah. But I learned a lot about pitch and phrasing from Peter. I felt like I got a really good education on that record about that. And then that album spawned Only Human as well, that song. We had an interesting thing happen, though, because we were signed to...
You were on a different label, right?
I was on Attic in Canada, but I was on 10 Records. It was a boutique label of the Virgin brand out of Europe. I got signed out of 10 Records in London, but I was... technically, on Virgin out of Munich was they had really, really wanted to bring me on board, but they felt that that office would be better to work in the, on the direction of the record and their A&R department and stuff. So I ended up, the president of Virgin at Europe called Attic and said, I love this song, Only Human. Please let me make it the first single in Europe. I promise you a gold record if you do. And I remember saying to my label, that is, it's a beautiful song, but that's going to freak my old fans out. They're looking, we need to release a rock song. I think it's a mistake. But unfortunately, in that world, the corporate world, you can't fight with money, right? It's like the man holding the biggest bag of money gets the final say. So they did it, and it was a mistake. When I went over to tour, my first few shows were not very well attended because fans thought that I had sold out. However, word back in the day when we didn't have the internet, but we had lots of media and you know paper publications and things like that. Word spread really quickly that the show totally rocked. So by the end of that 6-week tour, we were back on track. And then they made a different choice for the second single.
Well, it's Lee frickin' Aaron, of course it rocks.
Yeah, thank you. But that single was one of my first charting singles in Canada.
Right. That's like, when things started to change for you a little bit.
It charted on AM radio in Canada. So there you
What's AM radio, Lee? Explain. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. I didn't even really know at the time, but...
Super cool. So then that kind of takes us up to, you know, 1989's Body Rock. I mean, wow. That's part one of my interview with one of my heroes, Lee Aaron. You're going to have to come back tomorrow to hear the rest, because we're going to talk about gold albums, Body Rock. I mean, Lee explodes through the freaking roof. And we're going to talk about her new upcoming tour and everything. So please download, subscribe, review, stick around. Come back tomorrow, because this is going to be freaking awesome. This is Keith Shannon for Instant Authority Expert. We'll see you tomorrow.
Now you've added yet another weapon to your battle for success. Need more? Visit instantauthorityexpert.com/tools to download our free guide to the 5 top tools that authority experts can't live without. And we'll see you next time on Instant Authority Expert.